At Quite the Thing Media, we aim to bring you the best podcasts produced by independent creators, made without constraints.
Hello, and welcome to Podcast Tone. If you know the name of the podcast you want to listen to, press 1 now. Using the letters on your keypad, please enter the first three letters of the podcast you're looking for now. The Indie Podcaster, hosted by Podcast Father, with today's special guest, Edward Havens of the Film Jerk Podcast, an excellent choice. Here's your podcast now.
You've been searching for a podcast. Want to know about some great artist? Yeah. You've come to the right place. Indie Podcaster, with your host, the Podcast Father.
Welcome to Indie Podcaster. I'm your host, Jeff, a.k.a. Podcast Father. Clara Santamal is joining me from 48 Hours. She's a producer and creator of host of Final Days on Earth podcast. Did I say Clara? I meant Claire. I don't know what the hell I said. I'm sorry. Claire, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I think you're getting even better at the Santamal. I'm really feeling, you know, that you believe it when you say it. And I love that.
It's my audible, you know, I got to call an audible. It's Claire, Santamal. Okay. Today, we're going to talk about the Film Jerk podcast with Edward Havens. I've listened to a few episodes myself, to say the least. Did you get a chance to check one out, Claire?
I did. You know, I love a good 1980s movie, kind of a comfort movie. So he goes through some classics as well as some lesser known titles.
Well, I know you're a 90s kid, but his,
I'll take it.
We're the same age, I know. I thought it was a good joke, though. He talks about 80s films, 80s cinema quite a bit. He's a big supporter of some of the lesser-known independent films as well. He managed a movie theater forever and just recently retired. So cinema, movies are a big part of Edward's life.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting that he had managed a movie theater for like something like 34 years and... what an interesting job. I mean, I always, back when movie theaters were showing new releases, you know, my husband and I, we see almost everything that comes out. It's kind of like our date night thing to go see a movie. And so we've really been hurting with the movie theaters not, you know, doing those new releases. But we found all sorts of stuff streaming online, sort of expanded our reach for different kinds of movies, more independent stuff than we would normally watch.
I need to do better about getting to the movies. I haven't been much in a long time, but it was sure as hell a really cool thing in junior high, though. I remember we had an old movie theater where I'm from, and the wall blew in on it, so they had to build a new one. And when they built it, it was incredible. It was the place to hang out and go. So to me, it takes me back to some of those childhood memories as well. That was like,
oh yeah, getting dropped off at the movie theater with like $20 in your pocket. Nothing better.
Well, I rode my bike there and got sweaty as hell, but same thing. Yeah. You have your parent drop you off, right? Yep. And that was the cool place to hang out. That and the skate corral. Hell, I can't skate though. So that's why I started going to the movie theater more. You don't want to see me skate. Oh, Lord. Man.
Do they do skating rinks anymore? Because I remember that too. That was a big social event, like junior high.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if they do.
Elementary school.
Yeah. I called them Well, they were the razor blades to me because it was deadly to me. I was so terrible. But yeah, rollerblades were cool. How does this have anything to do with the Film Jerk podcast? I'm not sure, but
80s. These are all 80s flashback things.
Oh, okay.
I think we can make it work. But I liked, you know, yeah, because he doesn't just talk about movies. He also talks about cultural references from the 80s and, you know, different things that were going on at the time, current events that influenced the movies themselves. So it's a great trip down memory lane for some 80s nostalgia.
In the meantime, we'll definitely go into highlight, shine some light on the cool things Edward Havens does as a creator.
Yeah, you've got 60 episodes that you can binge that he's done already. So plenty of time for you to get your fix from the Film Jerk podcast.
For sure. Make sure you check it out and support Edward. Let's get into that interview. But before you do that, I'm going to take care of a little business. Jeff here. I want to talk about a few things that keep this podcast going. If you like the work that I'm doing, I encourage you to share it with a friend. That really is the best way to spread the word about Indie Podcaster. I would love it if you would go to your favorite podcast listening platform, may it be a Apple or Good Pods, and leave me a rating. Throw me some stars if you would like. All that word of mouth and sharing reviews of this podcast does help. This podcast and myself are proud member of Quite the Thing Media. Quite the Thing Media, podcasts that speak to you. Go check out all the great independent creators from around the world. It is a community-based podcast network. Check it out. It's great. QuiteTheThingMedia.com. If you want to check out my page, it's QuiteTheThingMedia.com/podcastfather. You can request a review from me on site or submit a form to participate on this very podcast. Check it out. I highly encourage you to download and listen to your podcast on the Good Pods app. This app is awesome. You can see what your friends and influencers are listening to. They've got groups for all your interests. I've got two groups I highly suggest you check out. I've got the Indie Podcast group. I've also got the True Crime Obsession group. If you're an indie podcaster, Good Pods is for you. They've done crazy amount of things these last couple months to reach out and help indie podcasters. They've got tip jars on there for your podcast. They've got performance charts that are based just on independent podcasts. Make sure you download the app and check it out. PodPage is a proud sponsor of this podcast. PodPage is an amazing resource to build your podcast website. You want them big search engine hits. You want to be out there. You want to leave your mark in the digital world. And this website makes it extremely easy to do that. You can set up your podcast website in just a few minutes. Make sure you check it out, podpage.com. That's enough of all that. Let's jump into this awesome interview. Joining me today is Edward Havens. Did I say that right, Edward? I don't want to butcher your name.
Yes, it is Havens.
I almost said Heavens. That'd sound pretty badass too, though, right?
Yeah, no, actually, that is my name, although it's fine. Yeah, Edward Havens.
Havens, they're both badass. It'll be good. Anyway, he has a podcast, the Film Jerk Podcast. Go ahead and take a minute, tell us about it. I know it's got a 1980s cinema theme, but I'll let you describe to the audience.
Yeah, so I'm in my early 50s, so I grew up in the 80s, and 80s cinema has always been a favorite of mine with so many different movies and genres. It was kind of the last big bastion of independent cinema or foreign cinema having mass acceptance in theaters before the way that cinema has become so fractured in the last few years. And now you have either massive blockbusters or little independent films, but are somehow supported by like the likes of Brad Pitt as a producer. So it's just something that I grew up with and I have a lot of knowledge about. I was a movie theater manager from 1986 to 2020. So 80s cinema kind of formed who I was as a person. In 2019, I just decided there was a podcast called 80s All Over. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It was a fantastic podcast where two of my friends, Drew McWeeny and Scott Weinberg, who are very well-known film critics online, started a project where they were going to talk about 80 movies 1 month at a time for an entire 10-year period. Obviously, they would do two shows a month, so it would actually only take 5 years. But unfortunately, a little after 2 years, life had them stop. And I had been interested in doing a podcast, but the podcast that I wanted to do was already kind of being done by 80s All Over. So when they decided to stop doing it, I decided to fill in the gap, so to speak, but do it differently from the way they were doing it. Instead of focusing on all the films of one specific month in chronological order from January of 80 to December of 89, I decided to do a variety of things, talk about a specific filmmaker's films during that decade or a specific distributor, because there are a lot of movies that are only 40 years old that a vast majority of people have not heard of today because they were made by smaller filmmakers, they were distributed by smaller distributors who are no longer around, and their libraries were bought by other companies who were bought by other companies who were bought by other companies because of the big names in their library. So these littler titles aren't really around anymore. I did a show recently about a company called Film Dallas. They originally started out in Dallas in the early 80s. Their thing was that they were going to make low budget films, and at least 25% of them needed to be made in the Dallas area. So the first couple films that they made were Kiss of the Spider Woman with William Hurt. He won the Academy Award for Best Actor in 1985. And The Trip to Bountiful, which was actually shot in Dallas, where Geraldine Page won the same year for Best Lead Actress. And all of a sudden, this company decided, well, we're not going to just produce movies. We're going to distribute movies and make them. They've distributed 8 movies over the course of 2.5 years, and only one of them is currently available on video, even though they're from 86, 87, 88. 7 of the 8 movies that they made and distributed are not available in any form since their original VHS release in the late 80s. You can't stream them. You can't buy them on Blu-ray. You can't rent it from anywhere. And so I have all of this knowledge about all these films that I not only knew about, but have often seen. And so it's a way to kind of hopefully reintroduce these movies to a new audience. And if I'm talking about a movie that enough people want to see, that the people who own the copyrights to those movies will hopefully bring them back out in some form. So part of it's educational, and part of it is a kind of a, let's get these movies back in circulation again, because there are so many movies from the early days of cinema, from 1895 to 1930, that are completely gone because they weren't kept stored properly. They weren't stored under the best conditions. They deteriorated over time. And now they figure that there are 80% of the movies made in the first 35 years of cinema are gone. There's no record of them anywhere because of the way that film was made back in then with nitrate film that it deteriorated. There's a Lon Chaney movie, you know, The Man of 1,000 Faces, and it's considered, I forget the title of it at the moment, it's considered his best performance by those who saw it way back when, but the film is completely gone now. We're talking about a major star like Lon Chaney. You and I, nobody else will ever get this chance to see this movie simply because they didn't take care of the movies the way we consider preservation now. But even now, we're only preserving all of the top titles. We're not preserving the littler films that maybe had young stars or small budgets, because, you know, when you want to sit down and watch Netflix, what do you choose? You probably choose something that you've heard of. You don't choose the little indie movie from 35 years ago with people that you've never heard of that might actually be interesting. And so it's kind of a mission statement to bring these movies back in a way.
That's great. So you mentioned 2020 as far as when you stopped the cinema management. Was that COVID related or?
It was COVID related. So my theater here in Los Angeles, on Sunday we were open and on Monday we were closed. And now the theaters are reopened. I love movie theaters. I love going to the movies. I just don't trust people to the point of being honest about their health. And I'm not going to sacrifice my health for someone else's entertainment. I've decided that rather than go back to theaters, I've retired. And thankfully, I'm in a position that I can comfortably retire.
Absolutely. No, I just wanted to make sure that, because when you hear the year, right?
Actually, absolutely what happened. It was, we were operating like normal one day, and then all of a sudden we got the call. Literally at 7 in the morning, you're closed. And we spent a year, you know, in Zoom calls with my coworkers trying to figure out when we're coming back. We were originally hoping to come back in June, then we were hoping to come back in August, and things just kept getting worse and worse and worse. Ironically, today's the day that California, quote unquote, reopens completely. Right. But there's so many stories about people who have been faking their vaccination records and creating fake documents to make it look like they're vaccinated. And I'm 53 years old. I am not in the best of health. I'm not ready to leave this plane of existence yet. So rather than take a chance on somebody else being a good person, I have the ability to not work for a while and survive.
For you going back, you focus on the 80s, going back to the 80s, how big of a experience, how big of an ordeal was it to be able to view those movies in a cinema?
Well, back then it was rather simple. I grew up in Los Angeles and I moved up to the Bay Area in 1982 and then kept bouncing back and forth between Los Angeles and Santa Cruz. So when I was living in Santa Cruz, it was a little harder simply because it's a smaller town. It's a college town. It has less theaters available to me. But growing up as a teenager in early 20s in Los Angeles, going to college, and I could hop in my car and I could drive 30 miles in any direction and literally see any movie I wanted. There was a theater up in Alhambra that specialized in Hong Kong movies years before Jackie Chan broke through in America in the mid-90s. But I could go to Alhambra and a straight shot up the 710 freeway and go see a Hong Kong movie that's still playing in Hong Kong at that moment with English subtitles, because I don't speak Mandarin or right. Cantonese. And then you have so many art house cinemas and you had so many repertory theaters. So I was still able to even see movies from the 50s, 60s, and 70s in a movie theater. Larry Karaszewski, the co-writer of Ed Wood and Dolomite Is My Name, just a couple days ago posted on Twitter a sheet from the New Art, which is a local art house theater in Los Angeles run by Landmark Theaters that's very well known for its programming from the 70s and had all these great movies. And he was asking, it's like, has anybody seen the Alan Bates movie, The King of Hearts, in many years? Because it used to be a staple on the repertory cinema. I used to play double features with Harold and Maude all the time. And as a teenager and in my 20s, when repertory theaters were still a fairly big thing in cinema, you could see that pairing three or four times a year at just a single theater. And now in Los Angeles, you have Quentin Tarantino's theater, the New Beverly, and that's it. If you want to see old movies on screen right now, you have one choice in Los Angeles. The Academy is opening a new museum with a new theater in September. They'll be showing a lot of great classic movies. UCLA has a massive library of films, but of course, because of COVID, they're not showing anything at the moment. Growing up in California, specifically where I was living, I always had the opportunity to see a wide variety of movies. Even in Santa Cruz, which has a population less than 100,000 people in the 80s, there was a repertory theater called the Sash Mill, where I could catch up on older movies from the 50s, 60s, 70s as a kid of the 80s, when VHS was still growing and you didn't have the massive library that companies eventually put those videos out on. And even now, there's a lot of movies that were released on VHS in the 80s and 90s that have never been available on DVD or Blu-ray or streaming. So it's kind of depressing that there's so many movies. I have an 11-year-old nephew who loves movies. And there are so many movies that I would love to share with him, not just from my era, but from the era before. And I can't do that because they're simply not available. So he will not have the same kind of film education that my father gave me, or I gave myself as I got older, simply because of a lack of availability, because it does, they only concentrate on Back to the Future, Top Gun, Gandhi, you know, the bigger mm-hmm. titles that people recognize with the stars that people recognize. Those are the movies that are the ones that you see most often on streaming services or available on VHS or on Blu-ray now. Columbia Pictures just announced yesterday they're releasing a box set of classic movies restored to 4K glory. And they're all recent titles like The Social Network. I love The Social Network. I have it on 4K Blu-ray already. And Columbia has so many classic movies from nearly 100 years of their existence, going all the way back to Frank Capra movies like It Happened One Night. And they've decided that their quote-unquote classic movies that they're going to restore to 4K is an 11-year-old movie from one of the best-known filmmakers around. Yeah, but there are so many great movies that we could talk about outside of the main 50 or 100 or 200 that regularly get talked about. A lot of movie podcasts only concentrate on the movies that they expect listeners to listen to because it's the movies that they've heard of.
Right.
Why talk about a Brazilian movie called Man? It's an Argentinian movie called Man Facing Southeast, which is a brilliant movie, when you could talk about Top Gun, which came out the same year.
Right.
Which one do you think is going to get more listeners, Top Gun or Man Facing Southeast? So I talk about Man Facing Southeast because nobody else is.
Right.
It actually did come out on Blu-ray in 2018 after not being available on video at all for 30 years. It's because there was a group of people who made it their mission to get this movie released. I think it was Cohen Media Group who run the Fantastic Quad Cinema in New York City and now own Landmark Theaters. They also have their own distribution company that does a lot of restorations and re-releases of older movies. I believe they're the one who put it out. But from 1988 to 2018, if someone was talking about Man Facing Southeast, you could not go online and rent it or buy it or stream it. It just simply was not available unless you wanted to buy an old VHS copy from Amazon.
When you see the fall of video retail, Blockbuster to be a good example,
right?
You could find a lot of hidden gems in those kind of stores. When that industry went away, right? You think now it's in more of a situation where the distributors can elect historical value of films?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a simple matter of economics. In order to bring a movie from the 30s or 40s, 70s or 80s into what the quality of video and sound that people expect today, that costs money. You have to clean up the 35 millimeter print of any dust articles or things that dilute the soundtrack with pops and hisses. And then you have to rescan it in a scanner, and that has to go frame by frame by frame. And a 2-hour movie, 24 frames a second, you're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of individual images that have to be scanned individually at an extremely high rate of picture in order to have the same quality. So why spend the amount of money, and it's in the six figures, to do a new scan of a movie? Why spend that money if you're not going to recoup it because you allowed that movie to become lesser known? You didn't promote that movie. Back in the 80s, when VHS was a big thing, you didn't need a high quality scan of a movie. You just needed something that looked good enough on VHS, because we didn't know about 4K or even DVDs. We didn't have that yet. We didn't have that quality. The best you had was Laserdiscs. Do you remember Laserdiscs from the 80s? Mm-hmm. So, you know, Laserdiscs, some companies, there were two different speeds you could play a Laserdisc at. One speed was allowed an hour per side, but you couldn't stop and freeze frame. Like if you saw something in a movie and you wanted to capture a frame, you wanted to see what that was, you couldn't do that. You just played for an hour. And then there was a secondary speed that was 30 minutes per side, where you could actually like if you wanted to see one of the heads exploded in a David Cronenberg movie, you wanted to see how they did it from what it looked like with the real actor, and then it changes to the dummy right before the head explodes. You could actually go frame by frame by frame. The quality on a Laserdisc back then was like 360. You know, now 2180 is the norm with 4K. So you're talking something that had the eighth of the clarity of a 4K Blu-ray today, where you could see those individual frames. And that's why Laserdisc for many years was the best format. But those companies, even the companies like Criterion, who started off making all those high quality Laserdiscs, if you look at their list of movies back in the 80s, you're talking 2001, A Space Odyssey, you're talking Blade Runner, Citizen Kane, the first three Bond movies, Dr. No, From Russia with Love and not Goldfinger. I forget what the third one was. But you had the top movies that people would be purchasing, because if you're putting that kind of money into creating that media, you need to make sure that you're making your money back. Because if you're spending $100,000 on something and you're only making $50,000 back, eventually you're going to go out of business. And so I think that's what happens now, is that with the streaming services, you've got Paramount has their own streaming service, and Sony has a couple of streaming services like Crackle, if I remember correctly, unless they recently sold them. All these companies have their own streaming services, but the MGM had their own high definition cable channel for many years. And they actually did do some older scans of older movies because it was supplying their own channel. So that's where you're seeing a bit amount of restoration of some older titles, is when the streaming companies are owned by the distributors who own the movies, and they need more content, for lack of a better word, for their channels. But if you made a movie in 1986 called Patty Rocks with a budget of $350,000, with Chris Mulkey, who you might know from the original 48 Hours and a lot of other movies, you recognize the actor, but, and this is probably his, the best movie he's in, but again, it was made independently on a low budget from a independent distributor who hasn't existed since the 80s. And why spend the money if it's not your movie, or you don't have the ability? I don't even know who owns this movie, Patty Rocks, anymore, but it's a great movie. It's worth seeing once. It's about two male chauvinist pigs who gets kind of schooled by the lover of one of them, who's pregnant with his baby, even though he's married with a family somewhere else. So it's a great battle of the sexes movie, and it's hilarious. And it was originally rated X because of its language. It was actually a little bit of a sensation back in 1988 when it was finally released in theaters, because of its X rating. And do you know the movie, this film is not yet rated, about the ratings board? So Kirby Dick, the director of that movie, was the first assistant director on Patty Rocks. So he was there when he saw the ratings battle. And that actually was the genesis of his idea for making, many years later, this film is not yet rated, because he saw firsthand the insanity of a movie like Patty Rocks, which had no violence, very little, if any, nudity, but was rated X for saying the F word 73 times, while a movie like Scarface, which was extremely violent, heavy drug use, over 200 uses of the F word, got rated R because it was a studio movie from a big time director, Brian De Palma, with one of the biggest stars, Al Pacino. You know Scarface, but you don't know Patty Rocks because of the disparity between studio movies and independent movies.
I'm proud to announce that the podcast father, myself, Jeff, and Podpage are teaming up for this sponsorship. Podpage is great, guys. Like I was telling you earlier, it is so critical to have an actual podcast website. I know the link trees are used a lot, but you need an actual website. You need something that's going to show up in Google. You need something that's going to show some hits, a trail that will lead to your podcast. And there's not a better way to do it than Podpage. You can build a beautiful podcast website in 5 minutes. Automatically create a listener-friendly podcast site from your RSS feed. Customize the design to create a professional look you'll be proud of in just a few clicks. There is no coding or technical knowledge necessary. There's a free trial to give this a shot, and there's different packages ranging from free to all the goods and gadgets, but still at affordable prices. Podpage is big supporters of indie podcasts, so make sure you support them also. Go on podpage.com and get your podcast website set up. With that being said, we will roll into this segment sponsored by Podpage, where we will play a trailer from a different indie podcast every episode. I hope you enjoy it and give them a listen after you're done listening to my show. Then afterwards, we'll jump back into the interview.
Oh my God, John, were you up on Wikipedia all night?
John, are you okay? You're shaking.
You guys,
You will not believe what I just read on Wiki. Welcome to Reddit on Wiki, the poorly researched, semi-funny podcast on random stuff we find on the internet.
Who are you talking to?
And why are you shaking so much?
Subscribe to Reddit on Wiki on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Sean, I'm scared.
Me too, buddy. Me too.
So, is that even bigger now, or do you think it's less, the disparity that you speak of?
It's different because in the time frame, there's been so many more movies made where they're still in the zeitgeist for some reason. There's a lot of very bad movies that are still getting rescanned and turned into 4K Blu-rays because they still have a cult audience of sorts. But when you talk about these older movies, there's a lot of times where you don't even know who has the proper materials. Don Coscarelli, who made the Phantasm movies a couple of years ago, put a call out on Twitter. He made a fun little B movie back in the early 80s called The Beastmaster. And they actually were going to do a 4K scan of it for a release. I forget if it was Vinegar Syndrome or one of the other specialty labels that does restorations of B movies. But he could not find a print of his own movie that he made 40 years ago. And Beastmaster is not a little known cult movie. It actually was a fairly sizable hit when it was released in theaters in 1982. But the director needed to put a call out to film collectors to find his own movie so that they actually could get it out into theaters or get it onto video. Because that's the nature of our industry in this day and age, where only the biggest movies are the ones that have the perceived value are being properly brought back to audiences.
There's a lot of things that have changed, obviously, but yeah, that's a major one. Then you have all the buyouts, and then it's constantly seems like it's changing hands. And then when that happens, there's probably a lot more. You don't think about the piece of who owns the rights to all these movies that right. could or may or may not have historical value. So then you're kind of in limbo. You don't know what's going to happen every time something's bought. And that's kind of the things I don't think we think about.
No. Do you remember the Toxic Avenger from the 80s? Horror movie, horror comedy. It was a low budget independent movie from a company called Troma in New York City. They're actually about to remake it. A big budget Hollywood remake with Kevin Bacon and Peter Dinklage. But they actually were also the company where James Gunn, the director of the Suicide Squad and the Guardians of the Galaxy movies, he got his start at Troma. I worked for them in the mid 2000s in New York City. And one of my jobs was to kind of keep track of all of the things that they owned. They owned more than 1,000 titles from buying out various film libraries from companies that went bankrupt, where even the owners of the rights to these movies, Troma, didn't know what they even had, let alone knew where the materials were. They had hundreds and hundreds of movies that they bought from these little distributors because of like one or two movies that were minor hits.
Then you get all of them.
And you get all of them, and then you don't care. There was one, they had a 1973 movie with Ingrid Bergman, the star of Casablanca, in a children's movie called From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil T. Weiler, if I'm remembering the title correctly, where that could easily be an exploitable movie for families. With a well-known star, Ingrid Bergman, never got released. Troma still owns the rights, to the best of my knowledge. They still have never put it out in any kind of format. You can find it on YouTube. Like somebody took a Danish copy of a VHS from the 80s and uploaded it to YouTube. And then you have to pray that the subtitles generated by YouTube are proper. But there's an English language dub of it. And you have a company that buys titles for exploitation purposes, but then they're not exploiting a lot of the titles that they have, that you have movies, you know, they had a couple movies that were early films with Burt Reynolds or Robert De Niro that they would put out, or they had an Italian movie from the 60s with Dustin Hoffman before The Graduate. So you had exploitable items, but of course, you know, Dustin Hoffman, Robert De Niro. Why not exploit Ingrid Bergman, Oscar-winning actress? You know, you have all these other people who are Oscar winners. Why not exploit this one that actually might be enjoyed by families? So what are they doing now? They make these low-budget horror movies, and then they sell their most famous IP to another distributor so that they can make a big-budget remake, and then they get a little bit of money back from, you know, the selling the rights and a little bit of money from the making of it. But again, if you don't know where your materials are and you don't know what quality they're in, you don't know what you have. And you're never going to give it a thought, because out of sight, out of mind. And then you can talk about the Universal fire back in 2008, Universal Studios. There was a fire on the back lot where hundreds of thousands of master recordings from jazz greats and rock greats were lost in a fire, because they were stored literally on the lot in horrible conditions, literally no conditions, just inside the facades that they used for filming. And so there's these great recordings by Thelonious Monk and Charlie Parker that have been lost to time because some company acquired them through the bankruptcy of another company. And it's like, well, we've got the master recordings, but we're just going to keep them in a building on the back lot. And then when the back lot burns down, you know, all we have left of those recordings are the copies, the second and third hand, fourth hand copies that have been made of them. We no longer have the masters to hear with any kind of clarity exactly what these legends were doing in the studio.
As a creator, you touched on already, and you're still been talking about it, your objective is to help preserve that through this podcast and educate people about these films that is where I think we're calling it lost in time. These films that could be lost in time, which is a very good, and it's a really creative passion and hobby that you've started.
Thank you.
So how did you, and how do you lay that out in a podcast? I mean, I've listened to your podcast. How did you go about even wrapping your mind around laying this into podcast form?
So the first show I did was, I actually did a test before I did the first official episode. And it was a company called the Weinstein, the Weintraub Entertainment Group. They were, if you've seen the Ocean's 11's movies with Brad Pitt and George Clooney, Jerry Weintraub produced those. He was a music producer who became a film producer who eventually started his own distribution company. And because I had seen all of these or played all of his movies, because the theaters that I were working at the time, we actually ended up playing every single one of the movies they released. So for me, it was just a matter of, let me see how this goes. And the sound recording was horrible because I was learning on the fly, right. But the format felt good. And then the first official one I did was actually the films of John Hughes, because the day that I recorded it, or the day I planned on recording, was the anniversary of his passing he passed earlier, but the day I recorded it in 2019 was the anniversary of his passing. So it was rather simple. You start with the first movie he wrote and you work your way to the end. You do it chronologically. And that's was pretty much what I ended up doing, is that whether I'm talking about a filmmaker or a distribution company or an actor or however, it just seems chronologically seems the best way to do it, because you're telling a story about a person, a company, whatever. And so start at a certain time. When I did a show about Sigourney Weaver, I did a little bit about her life before she became an actress, a little bit about her career in the 70s before Alien, and then concentrated on her 80s movies, and then did a kind of summation of her career after the 80s. Seems rather simple. But then when you get to talking about somebody like Martin Scorsese, one show is not enough. So I ended up doing an entire series, doing one episode for each of the films he made in the 80s. But I didn't feel like doing chronologically. The first movie chronologically for Martin Scorsese in the 80s was Raging Bull, which is a movie that I have a lot of trouble with. I think it's a fantastic movie, but I also think it's a very troubling movie for the character that it seems to glorify. So I actually bounced around. I started out with my favorite Scorsese movie of the decade, which was 1986's Color of Money. And then I went to Last Temptation of Christ in 88 because of the history of the movie, the history of the protests against the movie. And it was something that I had witnessed firsthand because I actually ended up seeing the movie the first show, the first day in San Francisco with thousands of protesters threatening to burn the building down and police keeping the peace. It was a crazy time. So for the Scorsese one, I kind of bounced around just to keep it interesting for me, but I wanted to talk about The Color of Money because when people talk about Scorsese movies, they talk about Raging Bull. They talk about Taxi Driver. They talk about Goodfellas, Casino, and then everything else after that. People don't talk about The Color of Money. They don't talk about After Hours or The King of Comedy so much, even though they're great movies with that are very well made. When we talk about Scorsese, we only talk about a couple of movies because those are his admitted masterpieces. And so now for me, I just go where my passion strikes. So this week I'm doing a show with an old friend from high school who's now a filmmaker herself. And she came to me with an interesting idea a year and a half ago that we finally recorded last Saturday because it was the first time I felt it would be better for us with our relationship over 35 years. I thought it would be better for us to bounce off each other in the same room rather than bounce off each other through Zoom or something else. And I felt it was a much better show that also has taken a much longer time to edit because when two very good friends who have a very shared history over 35 years get together, things tend to wildly get off course. So it literally depends. And then the show after that, I've already started writing, but I have no idea what I'm doing for the episode after that. It just kind of, once I'm done with recording, I give myself a day or two to kind of decompress. And then I start thinking about what I want to do next. And sometimes it'll be a movie. Sometimes it'll be a company. Sometimes it'll be something else. And now I'm getting the confidence more to talk to others. So I'm hoping to get more guests. I have several filmmaker friends that I've met over the years who have already agreed to be on the show. And I'm just want to open up the dialogue more about 80s movies that are forgotten, basically, because we don't talk about them.
Right.
So I want to be able to go to a person who makes horror films today and say, what are your five favorite horror movies of the 80s that don't get talked about? I'm not a big fan of horror movies. So for me, this will be an education for me as well, hopefully, as well as the audience. And go to a filmmaker known for comedies. And it's like, what are your five favorite 80s comedies that aren't talked about so much? I don't know if there's an 80s comedy that I don't know about, but I would love to see what they say. As the show continues to grow, I want to open up the dialogue more, even because I know there's movies I don't know about that I could talk about. I just don't know about them because I had a limited time frame to learn about them. There were a lot of movies that, as I do my research, that opened in New York City and then never came out anywhere else. So yeah, me being a teenager in Santa Cruz in 1984, I go when I'm researching shows that take place during 1984 and I'm on the New York Times looking at old issues of the New York Times and seeing what was playing, there's movies I've never heard of or movies that maybe got released a year and a half later with a different title that maybe, you know, became a minor hit, whatever. So that's for me, is that I want to educate others and I want to educate myself and I want to get these titles talked about again, because if we don't talk about them, we are going to lose them because there is no interest in them.
And that's a great concept for your podcast, Edward. I will say it's important to preserve the things that we think are important, right? And that's just one of the many aspects of it. Tell people where they can find your podcast, and then take a minute, if you had to pick one episode for the people listening to go listen to, what you would refer them to.
Well, the podcast is available pretty much everywhere except Anchor. For some reason, I can't get it to integrate with Anchor, but it's on Spotify, it's on Pandora, it's on Apple Podcasts, it's on Google Podcasts, it's on Amazon/Audible. You can pretty much find it anywhere. Search for the Film Jerk Podcast and on your favorite podcatcher, and outside of Anchor, you're sure to find it. And if there was one show, I would have to say it's actually a 4-part episode about David Putnam, who was a British producer, best known for producing the Oscar-winning Best Picture of 1981, Chariots of Fire. In 1987, he was hired by Columbia Pictures to be their studio head. And he only worked there for 15 months. And he got into a lot of trouble with Hollywood talent because he didn't like the blockbuster mentality that Hollywood seemed to be going to. He wanted to bring filmmakers from around the world into the American market to make the movies that they wanted to make if they were given the chance by a Hollywood studio. And so the first episode is basically just about David Putnam, and then 2, 3, and 4 are about the movies he produced at Columbia during that time frame. And there's a fascinating list of movies. Christopher Guest's first movie, The Big Picture, is amongst that list, but most people haven't heard of it because after he was fired, Columbia buried almost all of the movies that he made. The only movie that's from that Columbia period that most people have heard of is The Last Emperor, which won Best Picture in 1987. Christopher Guest is a very well-known filmmaker. The movie stars Kevin Bacon, a very well-known actor.
Oh yeah.
And a lot of comedy geniuses, including most of his friends from Spinal Tap. But it's almost unheard of today, even though it's got all of the star power, because for some reason, after the person who replaced Putnam in 1987, she buried it, and it kind of just stayed buried. It's not a great movie. It's not the movie that you would expect from Christopher Guest, but it was his first time as a writer and director. But there's a lot of interesting moments in there, but there's also a lot of great performers that you've heard of that are in it, but it's very hard to find today simply because, for some reason, because it's attached to David Putnam's name, even though most people don't even know who David Putnam is anymore, it still has that stigma within Hollywood. So that would be the series that I would guide people to, because it was kind of the whole genesis of me wanting to do the podcast in the first place, was to tell the story about literally the last filmmaking mogul in Hollywood. And then the interesting sidebar is that after I made the episodes, I got an email from now Lord Putnam's assistant in London, who wanted to let me know that he had listened to the show, and if there was ever any time that I wanted to talk to him, that I could, which I still haven't done 6 months later, because what am I going to say to an Oscar winning producer? I don't know what I would want to say to him. I don't even know if I would want to talk to him, because I spent all that time researching the time frame, and then what if he tells me I got something wrong? Even though some of the things that I got were specifically from stuff that he had said or written in the years afterwards, because he's very rarely talked about his time at Columbia Pictures. But there's a movie in there from a West German, one of the movies, it's called Me and Him with Griffin Dunne, who's a very well-known actor. He was also the star of Scorsese's After Hours. When this director, Doris Dory, was given the chance to make any movie she wanted under a certain amount of money in America, she decided to make a movie about a man whose thing has conversations with him that only he can hear. So so throughout this movie, he's having conversations with his you know what, and everybody else thinks he's crazy, but he kind of does all these things. But what filmmaker in today's era would even think about making a movie about a man and his talking penis? That's how, but that's the kind that, but those are the chances that a Hollywood studio executive was willing to make in the 80s, that even in today's era, where you consider all the incredible filmmakers and all the crazy things that have been made in the last several years, who's going to make a movie about a guy and his talking penis? That's how much the industry has changed, where we don't even take those kind of chances anymore. Was it a good movie? No. Me and Him was not a very good movie, but it's got a very interesting cast, and it's got an interesting premise, and Griffin Dunn's always good in whatever he does. But again, that's how much the industry has changed over the last 40 years, is that we don't make movies that take a lot of chances with storytelling. We occasionally will take a chance with a movie that we think will become a hit, and then if it doesn't, let's go ahead and spend another $100 million making something. But in the meantime, here's this little $2 million movie that's kind of cute. It's kind of sweet. It's a little raunchy, obviously, but we don't take those chances anymore. And so for me, I kind of see myself as a wannabe professor teaching those who want to learn about movies and filmmakers and genres that aren't really made anymore. But I hope that people will give it a chance, and I hope that they'll be entertained as they learn, and they'll come back for more.
I really appreciate you taking the time to do this interview today.
It was my pleasure.
I'm always here if you need anything, and just keep up the good work. And I encourage everybody listening to give the podcast a shot, the Film Jerk Podcast.
Yeah, well, I greatly appreciate the things that you're doing for indie podcasters. We need a voice. We need a champion. If you go and look on the charts of Spotify, of Apple Podcasts, of, you know, the most popular podcasts, it's always those that have big companies behind them and big names. How do I compete against Zach Braff? You know, how do I compete against Joe Rogan? How do I compete against some guy who's got 5 million Twitch followers talking about video games? I need to carve out my little niche however I can. And then having you be champions of us is amazing. And I don't know if anybody else voices their appreciation, but I greatly appreciate everybody who talks about the show organically outside of the show, or who retweets a tweet or whatever, asks me to be a guest on their show. That helps them and helps me. Because we're all together as podcasters. There's, you know, we might talk about 15,000 different topics. If we don't lift one another up, you're going to see a lot of people who just kind of get tired of doing it, because you're not making money. You know, you might not even get into any kind of sponsorship until you're in the thousands per episode. And then if you don't have a big company behind you, you're not getting there. Like, for example, one of the biggest episodes I've had in the last month is an episode I did in early 2020 about the producer Don Simpson. He produced Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop, Flashdance, where iHeartMedia decided to do a 24-part miniseries about Don Simpson. So people have been finding my podcasts about Don Simpson because they're hearing about this podcast about Don Simpson. So I'm gladly accepting anybody who mistakes a 24-series podcast about Don Simpson for my little 40-minute episode about Don Simpson. I'll take the listeners any way I can at the moment.
Yeah. Well, no, you've got you talked about the big names and all that, the backing of that, but you have the creative piece, and that's very critical also. So well done, and make sure you keep in touch, and I'm here for you.
All right.
Really do appreciate you listening to this episode and checking it out. I hope you continue to do so with the next. I hope you have an appreciation for what I'm trying to do here. Highlight all the different things all sorts of different creators are doing. I hope you get behind me on that and continue to join me on my journey. I'm Podcast Father, the Indie Podcaster. See you next time.